news and public affairs type programming, and then all through the night with more great music, and we'll do it throughout the weekend and back to you around again. That's because so many of your friends and neighbors have gotten involved to the extent and in the manner that makes sense to them. And you can too at KBOO.FM. You click on the thing where it says donate. Stay tuned.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle. Every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at KBOO.FM. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
You're listening to Good Vibes Only, a podcast on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Dresden, and today I have the duo behind Murder Boat Productions, an event production company. So, some questions that I want to ask you. Is there a model event which really is emblematic of what a Murder Boat Productions should be like?
Probably the first party has been a big template. But I think the party that really does capture the true essence of what we're trying to do was the world's largest blanket fort that had so many things that were core to what we're trying to do.
What are those core qualities?
I mean, we had a ball pit, we had a bear room, we had lots of arts and crafts to kind of bring out your inner child, dancing and hammocks to be lazy for a bit, relax.
Yeah, we had 13 domes and 60 activities. There was just so much going on. And we had both a daytime and a nighttime event. The daytime, we let all ages in for the first time. So we had two-year-olds having fun. So it was just really anybody could come and be silly. And it was just a magical feeling to watch that unfold.
And for the record, what was the record that you broke? I know that you broke the world record for largest blanket fort, but what did it come in at measurement-wise?
So our blanket fort was 6,734.22 square feet. That is shattering any for the world's largest
shattering
blanket fort.
There was no question as to what word was used. What qualities are you most hoping to create throughout your event?
Creativity at almost every event, if not every event. We've always had like graffiti walls and ways to like do art or live artists there to watch them create. So creating worlds too, whether I mean, creating worlds not necessarily people are taking part in during the event, but all of our volunteers are helping build something. They're the ones that are coming up with some ideas, helping us create the idea, so building a world around an event.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that, the interactive world building, because we always have the audience participate, if not through activities, through the theme and costumes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, costuming is huge too. We always encourage people to get dressed up, and that was one thing we were kind of hesitant about with Turbulence Live. Like, this is a new market. Are they going to be into it? Are they going to get dressed up? And we saw so many amazing costumes.
With the festival, with the world's largest blanket fort festival, how did you anticipate that that was something that people were going to love and flock to?
And what we initially do is often put up like a skeleton of an event, and then we get lots of feedback as people get excited and they talk to us, and the event is molded and shaped through this community effort, because people are adding what they want to see. And so by the time that it's time for the actual event, it's this just amazing group collaborative thing.
So what's the crowdsourcing process for this? Like, how do you choose the people who you want to be involved in this democratic election of what's going to be cool for the populace?
So it's kind of a combination of both, like what Sean was saying, posting on Facebook. Those are actually some of our most popular posts. We say, hey, what do you want to see? And that gets tons of interaction, tons of like, tons of comments. But then also asking our close friends, the Banana Tribe, what they want to see, what they think.
Yeah. A lot of people just cold message us, and we love that. We love to see people get involved that we don't know, because it's just a new opportunity. Some of the closest people that we worked with were just random Facebook messages that were like, hey, let's just give these people a shot and see what they have to say, and they just worked out amazingly.
How do you get community involvement in the festival? Because I imagine that in addition to putting on the event, you also have to look into security. You have to also look into securing licenses. You also have to look into these different venues, different performing artists. How do you get those communities interested in your event?
It's a lot of our network that we built for the last couple of years. Our first party, we didn't know any of that, and we okay. had no idea how we would even book a DJ, because we didn't know any. Now that we've done it so many times and we've been connected through so many amazing people, we have this large network that we're able to do it. And it's not just through our own events, but volunteering and attending other events, festivals in town, has really expanded our network, because Portland has so many talented artists and performers that it's just like there's so many to choose from at this point. It's amazing. And we try to cycle through them through different events, because we really want to showcase what the local community has to offer.
I think one of the coolest things is how many people just come to us. Like, we are not necessarily reaching out as much. People are saying, hey, I want to be a part of this. I want to do this thing. And we basically tell them, all right, do it. Run with it. Here's the budget. Let's see what you can do. Someone that had a really big part in the blanket fort was Alexa. She came to us, or I'm not sure if she came to us, we came to her. Whatever the case, she said she wanted to create a chill dome and have music and comedy and all kind of things happening in it. And she ran that whole thing entirely by herself. We gave her a budget, and it was a pretty small budget too. Mm. And she created something amazing with it.
Tell me more about like this team effort behind the scenes. Like, what do you think is really instrumental to a production event team like working together effectively?
I think all of us are very effective problem solvers, and all of us very passionate about what we're doing.
Yeah, so our team for any event has about 200 people working on it. And there are volunteers, there's staff, there's leads, there's organizers, there's...
So you have a team of hundreds of people behind the scenes putting mm-hmm. it together. And how many people come to the event?
Our first event, our smallest event, was 400. Uh-huh. And Turbulence will have as much as 1,600. Blanket Fort actually was our largest with 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm. 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 Got it. And so you were mentioning how all these different forces come together, and then you mentioned how you trust everyone's problem-solving abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was one thing that did take some learning, to like just trust people more, to give them, empower them to do things. Mm-hmm. And then here's a problem, solve it, I trust you. And they do.
Do you believe that festivals have the potential to affirm community virtues? Like, for example, Burning Man is a testament to how people can get together and live outside a money system.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that festivals could be an impetus for social change?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that people that often go to festivals, raves, burner style events are of a certain mindset, and I don't think they were necessarily always that way. Maybe some were, but I think going to those events opens your mind to a different way of doing things, a more accepting, more open, more compassionate way of living life.
Yeah, and then bringing back those values to the default world mm-hmm. is, I think, really powerful, and sharing that with the community.
Hmm. I'm curious to hear how Murder Boat Productions first came together.
It was almost 2 years ago to this day, because I just got a Facebook
right, yeah.
memory about it. Victor and I were at a party at Watershed, and there was some point when we were probably underneath this giant parachute as a guy banged on a shopping cart that we're like, this is really cool, and we need to do something similar to this, but we don't know how. How can we do this?
Wait, let's go into this shopping cart experience. What was going on?
Do you remember the name of the group? They were from somewhere in Central or South America, if I recall. And they just had a very theatrical way of doing their show. They had like banking on shopping carts. They sang. They played instruments, some sort, if I recall.
Weird instruments.
Weird with, like, instruments.
Pipes and funnels. And
so yeah. It was almost something. It was first and foremost, I'm picking up traces of being out of this world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was this out of this world musical performance happening, and it gripped the both of you simultaneously.
Absolutely.
For sure. And because previous to that, we had been doing our banana meetups. So the idea was, how can we do this, but with our own unique spin coming from bananas? Like, how can we combine that? And that's where the initial idea of Banana Warehouse Party, our first party, came from.
So this banana idea, so it seems like there's a longer origin story than just, like, how did two people decide to become event producers? So this banana tangent that you're talking about, what's this about?
Yeah, back in late 2015, so almost 4 years ago now, myself and five others had an idea for a monthly meetup that we called the Banana Bunch. Basically, one of my friends had a banana costume, and we wanted to meet other people, so we decided to host a meetup. We would all dress up in banana costumes and drink, and that was it. We had one rule: no monkey costumes. Mm-hmm. And we figured the rest would just kind of come together. Mm-hmm. Initially, three people showed up. We were really happy about that, decided to do it a second time. Over time, more and more people showed up. We got dozens and dozens until our first large party back in 2017, the Banana Warehouse Party, had 400 people. So this just idea kept gaining momentum and momentum, people being silly and people dressing in bananas.
So even prior to that moment on the dance floor, we had like joked about doing a giant banana festival at some point. And it was always kind of said half, like, that'd be really cool, but nothing's really happening to make it happen. And I think that was the point we realized, well, we actually could do something that's pretty cheap and, like, at the time we thought very easy, and we found out not so easy. By just renting a warehouse and throwing a banana party. And it just kind of grew from this small idea to this huge thing that sold out.
So the seed of the idea, though, were friends getting together in banana costumes. Why banana costumes? Why not taco costumes? Why not, like, why not monster costumes? Why did you focus on banana specifically?
Our friend had a banana costume already, so it was convenient, and there was really no other thought put into it.
Since then, bananas represent just being your inner self without any clothing or any status. You are a banana. You're all equal.
How can you bring a superficial quality when everyone's dressed in a banana suit? You might as well practice your authentic self because everyone else around you is.
When everyone's in bananas and looking ridiculous, it doesn't matter where you come from, or it just, you really can connect on this personal level. And that's what I really enjoy about it, because you're just connecting person to person.
And so in what way do you feel the community benefits from events that are thrown by Murder Boat Productions?
It's an alternative to typical nightlife. A lot of times you can just go to an overpriced bar or club and it's the same kind of thing. And we like to be very, very different. And that's adding a ton of weird, different activities or really crazy venues like boats and planes and blanket forts.
Our events also foster a lot of connection. We have a lot of activities, things to do. We prime people to interact together. Whereas if you go to a club, you're going to be on the dance floor together, but you're not really going to go meet people unless you go out of your way to meet people. At a Murder Boat event, you're likely to make a new friend, or maybe a romantic interest, or who knows what you'll find.
So I know that between you two, your portfolio for types of events you've run have ranged from private business to world's largest blanket fort festival. It sounds like being an event producer, not only are you organizing hundreds of people, but you're also put through a lot of different obstacles, a lot of stressful obstacles, voluntarily, I might add. And so you mentioned that you do it because you're passionate. Like, why is putting on events a passion for the two of you?
It's That's a good question. It is a lot of stress for many months leading up to it, as well as the event itself, as well as a lot of risk and just a lot of craziness. So on paper, it looks like not the best idea in the world. However, putting on the event and watching the smiles on people's faces and hearing the comments about how we have what we've done at these large scale things to really change the community for the better inspires me so much to just keep going through all the craziness, because it really, really is worth it at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it comes down to, like, you're putting in anywhere from 2 to 4 months of many, many long days to make this one day happen, and that one day makes up everything else.
Yeah.
Like, there's always the last, like, week or two where, like, I hate everything. I don't want to do this. We need to stop doing this. This is a horrible idea. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I'm like, oh, right. That's how we do it.
I think that about wraps it up.
Cool.
So this has been Sean and Victor, co-producers at Murder Boat Productions. My name is Dresden. Thanks for listening.
Hello. This is episode 39 of This Week with David Rovics, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts, with a new one up by Friday each week. You can also find my new semi-daily micro-podcast, Song for Today, by searching for Song for Today on most any podcasting platform. Now for this week's missive. I grew up on a bicycle, at least once I learned to ride. Somehow or other, I didn't manage to do that until the age of 10. But starting then, the bicycle became the ticket to freedom and independence, as well as another way to appreciate the natural world and get a lot of exercise. For many people who grew up in suburbs similar to the one I grew up in, what I'm describing will be familiar. Looking at it from this distant vantage point and back at the time, the reason is and was obvious. It was all about infrastructure. Walking from my suburban home to the town center took an hour or more. I only did that when there was too much snow on the roads for anything with wheels to function. Biking it took a fraction of that time. The nearest video arcade was several miles beyond the town center. Walking there and back would have been a day-long event, but by bike it was just a good little workout. All of this will be familiar to many. And then what happened next will be too. At the age of 16, I got a driver's license and inherited an ancient Volvo from my parents, which they were passing on to me both out of love and kindness, but also because the car was deemed to be no longer reliable enough to use for their interminably long commute from Connecticut to Long Island, which they both had to do multiple times a week. From the time I got that driver's license and car, I rarely rode a bike. There are so many forces in the society I grew up in, suburban America, that pushed me and most other teenagers and adults in that direction. With a car, it becomes easier to go still further than you could easily do with a bike, and so you do, for lots of good reasons, having to do with important things like getting an education and making money. And there's the question of your dating prospects and all those other social pressures. But fundamentally, it comes down to infrastructure. Young teenagers in the suburbs of America often become serious bicycling enthusiasts because the distances they'd need to go by walking are impossible. There's no mass transit to speak of, and nobody wants to ask their parents for rides all the time if they can help it, for a whole variety of different reasons. Once they're driving cars, however, the whole equation changes. Now they can really participate in the society, as it has been designed to function, by car. And it's not just the distances people often need to go that is the main problem here with infrastructure. It's not just how it is in a sparsely populated place like so much of the U.S. The spreading out of the population, in the way it spread out, were choices made by people and urban planners, governments, and corporations. Still, we are fed on a steady diet of the mantra that we are personally responsible for the climate crisis, and we have to do things like eat less meat and ride bicycles more. We are told this in so many ways, from early childhood. But despite all the propaganda, in the most bicycling cities in the U.S., the percentage of people commuting to work by bike on a regular basis is in the low single digits. Contrast this with cities like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, where it's the majority who is getting around by bicycle or mass transit. Is it something peculiar to the Danish or Dutch psyche that makes their entire societies as bicycle-obsessed as your average suburban American preteen? Or is there something else at work here? Obviously, It's once again about infrastructure, laws, what's easy, what's possible. Denmark and the Netherlands, being flat countries, of course, is hugely influential in this. Let's not minimize that. But there are many other flat parts of the world that do not have a dominant bicycle culture going on, such as most of the American Midwest. In Denmark, on the other hand, it's prohibitively expensive to own a car or fill its tank with gas, while bike lanes are everywhere, and they're all full of people of all ages riding in them. You're also not risking your life by taking a bike ride. Here in Portland, I see new ghost bikes cropping up everywhere, white-painted bicycles that friends of those killed while riding a bicycle often put up in their memory and to serve as a statement. The statement can be many things to many people. It can focus on the individual responsibility of the drivers, not to text and drive, not to drink and drive, etc., and or it can put the spotlight on the need for better, safer infrastructure, like real bike lanes, tunnels, and bridges. Meanwhile, there are cities in Scandinavia that have achieved zero annual traffic fatalities of any kind. They have done this not by relying on humans not to make human errors, but by creating infrastructure that makes a fatal accident very difficult to have. In Copenhagen, for a driver to hit a bicyclist, they generally first have to drive through a line of parked cars that separate the car lane from the bicycle lane. It is not a matter of crossing an imaginary line represented by some faded paint job they're calling a bike lane, such as at least 99% of the so-called bike lanes in the United States, in my conservative estimate. The UK, incidentally, is just as bad for bicycling as is the US, with no real attention having been paid to this form of transit in the development of the infrastructure of the country. So the idea of Extinction Rebellion activists being slandered by the Mayor of London and most of the British media for tying up not only car traffic but mass transit as well, on the basis that if they really cared about the environment, they wouldn't cause problems for commuters on the underground, is a lot like someone saying because 2 plus 2 equals 4 and using the underground saves petrol, using the underground is the solution to the climate crisis. It's very elementary school logic that falls apart immediately upon inspection, but it is totally mainstream from Sadiq Khan to the BBC, and it is pernicious. London and other British cities are ecological disasters with industrial-era infrastructure that is crying out for radical transformation of the sort that only massive government reprioritization of values and massive infrastructure investments can hope to deal with, as is very much the case in the cities of the U.S. and many other countries. Only after spending so much time in Denmark did I come to realize to what a tremendous extent it is all about infrastructure and the priorities of a democratically run society. Danish democracy has been controlled by active bicycle riders for a long time, with bicycle infrastructure spending being a significant part of the national budget every year since around the time I was born, and what has been achieved is obvious. Telling people to ride their bikes more often in places like London, Glasgow, New York City, or Chicago is like inviting people to die early deaths from either getting hit by a car or breathing the air made so foul by the dominance of the private car for the functioning of these societies as they are. Telling people to ride their bikes more often in Denmark, well, it's not necessary. It would seem like a very strange thing to do. How else are you going to get around? To the stooges of the real estate speculators, pretending to be viable political leaders who like to preach about mass transit and social inclusion while they reign over societies where rampant speculation on the real estate market means people are forced to live in further and further suburbs with less and less infrastructure and more dependency on the private automobile for their increasingly difficult prospects for survival, we must say no. This stops now. The solution is not your band-aids. It is a total transformation of the physical infrastructure of the society and serious, effective government regulation of the housing market. With all respect to those many good friends of mine who are actively striving to make Denmark an even better, more ecological, and more inclusive society, it is already an entirely different reality from what we know in places like the UK or the US, including in the supposedly progressive hotspots like Brighton or Seattle or wherever. In fundamental ways, it bears no resemblance. In Denmark, the question is almost never, shall we ride or drive? It's almost always the former. Yes, there are fewer bus routes than there used to be, and this is not the right direction to be going in. But the point is, it's still nothing like anywhere you've probably been, unless you've spent time in the Netherlands. These are the societies you get when you create the infrastructure for it. If you don't create that infrastructure, you don't get the society. We can do it too. But first, we have to stop deluding ourselves that the way forward involves anything other than society-wide collective action of the sort that brought Denmark its bike lanes.
Everybody's wondering what they're gonna do. Everything's a mess and folks are feeling blue. If your troubles got you down so much you can't abide, get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. 'Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, 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 ride. They're doing it in Eugene, Havana, and Shanghai. Even folks in Boston town are giving it a try, throwing out their gas tanks, the clean air by their side. Just get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. 'Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, ride, ride. It's good for your heart and it's good for your brain. When those fluorescent lights are driving you insane, your toes will tingle in your shoes when to the pedal they reply. Just get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. 'Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, ride, ride. You're having troubles with your lovers, the tandem's made for that. You'll work together wonderfully, or else you'll just go splat. Gonna shut down Main Street, make the bike paths far and wide, and get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. 'Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, ride, ride. Ride, 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 ride.
This has been episode 39 of This Week with David Rovics.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I am Susan Franson from KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa. On August 10th, the Gun Sense Forum of Presidential Candidates was held in Des Moines, Iowa. The forum was in the wake of mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio and El Paso, Texas. 16 Democratic candidates spoke at the event to make their bid to Iowans in the first-in-the-nation process. The forum was hosted and sponsored by three organizations, including Every Town for Gun Safety, Moms Demand Action, and Students Demand Action. We will hear from some of the candidates and members of a delegation of family and survivors of gun violence. John Feinblatt, president of Every Town for Gun Safety, introduces the first speaker.
We are here today after a week of heartbreaking tragedies in El Paso, in Dayton, in Brooklyn, in Chicago, and Baltimore. We are here because the American people deserve to know how our next president will address gun violence. We'll hear from the candidates shortly, but first, I want to introduce you to one of our movement's most fearless leader and the founder of Moms Demand Action, Shannon Watts.
In the 2018 midterm elections, we outspent the NRA and we outmaneuvered them. Our volunteers helped flip the makeup of the U.S. House of Representatives to be a gun sense majority, and we even sent one of our own, our former volunteer-turned-colleague, Lucy McBath, to Congress last fall. And across the country, we elected over 1,000 gun sense candidates from city council to Congress. And in 2019 alone, our grassroots volunteers helped enact 38 state laws in 17 states to reduce gun violence. Thanks to the hard work of gun violence prevention advocates, going into 2020, our movement is stronger than it's ever been, giving every gun sense candidate a clear advantage.
So let's get to it. Pastor Jackie Jackson is a gun violence survivor from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I come from a family of gun violence survivors. My son and I are both survivors of gun violence. I had a great nephew that was fatally wounded in Cincinnati just over a year ago. Three family members of mine were murdered in the city of Cincinnati. And over the past 5.5 years, I've had 12 family members murdered or wounded because of gun violence. My question to you, Representative Ryan, is what's the most important thing you think the Americans who want stronger gun laws can do to get our lawmakers to act?
We need to continue to mobilize the people of the United States to get behind this issue that has the support of Democrats and Republicans and hunters and veterans that say that these weapons of war should not be on the streets of the United States of America. Weapons are designed to kill lots of people very, very quickly. And we saw it in Dayton with within 30 seconds, 9 people are dead and almost 30 people are injured. And the cops could have not have responded any quicker. And all I can say is I pledge to you every ounce of energy I have, every ounce of fight that I have to continue to help build this out, whether it's in Ohio or anywhere else in the United States, you have my support. It's not gonna come from the top down. This is gonna come from the bottom up. With you, me, and all of us together. You're not gonna tweet your way into making this happen. This is gonna be knocking on doors, as my little Italian grandmother used to say, eyeball to eyeball. You tell your stories like you're doing, which is why in Dayton, I can't tell you the number of Republicans that came up to me and said, Congressman, please, this has gone on long enough, and it's time for us to act.
So let's go on to the next question. Roberta, a member of the Every Town Survivor Network from Columbia, South Carolina. Roberta?
In 2013, my only son, Nathaniel McKelvin III, 21, was shot and killed while sitting on his best friend's porch. Why do you think so many of your colleagues are still with the NRA? And how can we break that hold on Congress so we can pass meaningful gun safety legislations?
Get the money out of politics. And I support publicly financing election. And we have got to win the United States Senate back. That's a must. My opinion is we've got to have a nominee who can help our Senate candidates in the Senate seats that we have to win, which is North Carolina. I think we have a Senate race up here in Iowa. There's an open seat in Kansas. Lindsey Graham is up in South Carolina. Boy, that'd be nice. That would be nice. And Mitch McConnell is up in Kentucky. So
This is political. We've got to win elections. We're not talking about hunting rifles. We're not talking about protecting your home. We're talking about weapons of war on the streets. And I think the education proposal that I put out, dealing with trauma in our schools. 90% of school shooters come from the school that they went into. And so after Sandy Hook, they studied on how to try to prevent this from happening, and they came up with three recommendations. The gun safety issues that I mentioned, proper mental health coverage in the United States, and the third was social and emotional learning in every one of our schools. And I want to make sure there's a mental health counselor in every single school in the United States of America that needs one. I want to make sure that we have social and emotional learning and trauma-informed curriculum in every single school in the United States of America. I want to make sure that we have art therapy and music therapy and play therapy for our kids in every single school in the United States, so that we're dealing with the trauma that is behind the action. How do we deal with the trauma in our schools? We also need to get money to these schools to deal with safety issues. We've been underfunding public education now in the United States for a long time. So my plan has $100 billion in it for school infrastructure, which we could use for security issues in the school as the local school district sees fit. Moving away from how do we get test scores up to how do we help our kids and deal with the trauma, I think is the best way, the best preventative medicine we could possibly have when it comes to school shooting.
John Bullock.
When I was growing up, the NRA was a gun safety organization. It was a hunting organization. It was a shooting organization. If we could ever look at this issue as not a political issue, but as a public health issue, we know what to do. The majority of gun owners, the majority of NRA members, all of us think universal background checks make a heck of a lot of sense. That's how I got my gun. Majority of Republicans think that. Assault weapons, they're not used for self-protection. They're not used for hunting. We got to stop the sale of those as well.
We now shift to a question for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
If elected President of the United States, how will you prioritize gun safety in your administration?
I just met with some survivors of gun violence and heard their stories. And the thing that brings us together is that you never actually recover from gun violence in your life. Nobody should be able to come into a Congress at your corner or go to a concert or go into a house of worship and slaughter people in seconds. That's what it's about.
As president, how will you take on bad gun dealers and irresponsible gun manufacturers? Specifically, would you expand on PLACA? Thank you.
Yeah. PLACA, the immunity, civil immunity for the gun industry.
So I don't support civil immunity for gun manufacturers. I think that's one of the sweetheart deals that was made in the dead of night with the gun manufacturers because of the NRA. So if we want to end gun trafficking, we got to go after the greed and corruption rot at the center of the system, which is the greed and corruption of the gun manufacturers. The gun manufacturers spend a lot of money giving money to the NRA, and they spend millions of dollars every campaign cycle making sure Republicans don't stand up to the NRA and the gun manufacturers with the common sense reform. Gun trafficking is something that law enforcement is desperate to actually have a federal crime against. If they want to actually find these 1% of bad gun dealers, they don't even have the authority to cross states to make sure they can investigate these traffickers.
Our next question is from Lachey, a gun violence survivor from California. Lachey?
I was shot 5 times in front of my young children. Luckily, I survived, but all 5 bullets still remain in my body. Unfortunately, this experience is far too common. Domestic violence often turns deadly when combined with a gun. In an average month, 52 American women are shot to death by an intimate partner. And beyond that, 1 million American women alive today have been shot by their intimate partner. You know, I am one of them for more than 20 years now. I have lived with all these bullets in my body, put there by my ex-boyfriend. As president, how would you address the intersection of domestic violence and guns?
I have a piece of legislation to actually close the loophole that says you can get a restraining order against a husband, but what happens if it's a boyfriend, partner, friend? Some state laws don't allow you to get the protective order. And so I have legislation to mandate on the federal level that any intimate partner who feels they are at risk can get a protective order and have the guns taken away from the person who is threatening them. That has to be done. And this goes back to the NRA, sadly. Do you know that the NRA is opposed to the Violence Against Women's Act? They want to make sure that abusers have access to as many weapons as they want. They want to limit the number of people who could get a protective order against them or could have their weapons taken away. So you have to know what we're up against. It's the greed and corruption in Washington and money in politics. If we want to end gun violence in this country, we need publicly funded elections. We need to go after political corruption with clean elections. And I will do that as president.
I've heard both the president and the NRA focus on mental illness as the reason for gun violence. But evidence shows that people living with mental illness are far more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator of one. So comments like that not only distract from the real solutions, they also stigmatize those living with mental health issues. How do we ensure that our work to prevent gun violence doesn't increase stigma on those who struggle with mental illness?
Every other country in the world also has the same prevalence rate of mental illness, but they do not have the same rate of gun violence because we have such a large number of guns so readily available to so many people. So, as president, I will make sure that we do not stigmatize mental health and mental illness. I will fully fund mental health to make sure it is funded on par with every other medical issue. In Iowa, we have huge issues about mental health hospitals and clinics closing. There are not enough mental health professionals in this state, but it's true in almost, I think, every state. I don't think there's a state that has the level of mental health professionals they need. We need specific care for specific groups of people, our veterans suffering from PTSD. What is relevant for the debate of ending gun violence is taking on the NRA, taking on the Republicans in Congress who are unwilling to stand up to them, and taking on President Trump, who's lying every day about the source of gun violence.
You've got a room full of probably the best activists I've ever encountered in my entire life. What should they be doing in the next 4 weeks before the Senate comes back to make sure that Mitch McConnell brings up red flag laws and a background check bill?
Things are changing in America for the better because people like you are showing up to a forum like this. You're going right after the presidential candidates, demanding that they are on the same page as you are on all of these issues. That is absolutely your right, but it's also what makes our democracy work. Demand the change that you need. It's absolutely changing. The fact that President Trump tried to go to Ohio and Texas and was yelled at by activists, "Do something! Do something!" When young women like Emma Gonzalez can stand up and cry BS on every lie every member of Congress has ever told her, things are changing. When young advocates can stand up to members of the Senate and say, "I dare you to stop taking money from the NRA," and that senator was unwilling to say he would stop taking money, I'm telling you, things are changing. So do not give up speaking out, using social media to be heard, tweeting at Mitch McConnell saying, "Mitch, call the vote. Mitch, call the vote." We could pass universal background checks today. We could ban assault weapons. We could ban large magazines. We could have a federal anti-trafficking law today. So it's your voices that matter. So keep speaking up. Do not be silent. Just keep demanding it. I promise you, your voices matter.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots. We are hearing from presidential candidates and the survivors and families of gun violence at the Gun Sense Forum of Presidential Candidates held in Des Moines, Iowa on August 10, 2019. 16 Democratic candidates spoke at the event. You have heard from three candidates, Representative Tim Ryan, Governor Steve Bullock, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Speaking out and answering questions, we'll hear from Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, and Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Every mayor in the country is fighting gun violence with a hand tied behind our back. because of the failure of Washington, and often in our state capitals, actions that stop us from enacting common sense gun safety.
Good morning, Mayor.
Morning, Sharon.
In 1983, when two of my brothers and my best friend were shot, they all survived, and I was also there. And my best friend pushed me out of the way and saved my life. Several years later, six more of my loved ones were shot, and they didn't survive. In 1990, my nephew Michael. In 2004, my firstborn son Juan. In 2016, another nephew and cousin. In 2017, a third nephew, Darnell. And then in 2018, another cousin, Philip. All six of their lives was taken by senseless gun violence in Baltimore. Mass shootings capture the headlines, but we know that gun violence happens every day in America, especially in our cities. The same weekend as the shooting in El Paso and Dayton, there were shootings across Baltimore and Chicago. In addition, shootings by police harm communities like mine, leading not just to loss of life, but loss of trust. Can you tell us how you plan to address daily gun violence in our cities, including police-involved shootings?
It's unthinkable that we tolerate living in a country where that happens. The equivalent of a mass shooting happens every day. It just happens one incident at a time. And it's usually happening to people of color. We're the only country in the world with more guns than people. If more guns on the streets made everybody safe, we'd be the safest country in the world. We've got to change that.
Let's now go to Emily, who is a Moms Demand Action volunteer from right here in Des Moines.
There has been a rise in white supremacy and anti-Semitism. At the same time, we are seeing gun violence directed at the LGBTQ community, and in particular, trans women of color. What would your administration do to disarm hate?
In my action plan on dealing with gun violence, I also propose that we put $1 billion into the capabilities of the Department of Homeland Security on countering violent extremism here at home. By the way, this administration cut that. We need to radically increase it. But it's not just policy, it's culture. And as long as people who espouse that kind of hate feel like they're being validated from the highest office in the land, they will be emboldened and those movements will grow. It's one of many, many reasons why we need a different president as soon as possible.
Jane, who is a survivor from Washington State.
My 19-year-old niece, Veronica, was one of the six people killed in the Isla Vista shooting on May 23rd, 2014, near UC Santa Barbara. Research shows that restrictions on high-powered semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines can help prevent mass shooting injuries and fatalities. What are your views on the prevalence of those weapons of war in civilian hands?
I trained on some of these weapons. If I say that the M4 that I carried when I drove outside the wire in Afghanistan is like the AR-15s that are on our streets, some enthusiasts will fill up my Twitter feed explaining the finer points of how they're different. They're not that different. AKs, ARs, they have no business in our neighborhoods, in peacetime, in the United States of America. They are for war zones.
You've got an extraordinary group of activists here, moms, students, veterans, mayors. What advice do you have for them, particularly as we contemplate the Senate coming back in 4 weeks and possibly bringing up gun safety legislation?
First of all, keep speaking up. My God, keep speaking up. It's working. I know it may not feel that way because of the frustration of experiencing the same conversations recycling themselves for as long as I've been alive, and I'm frustrated too. But I want to point out that things really are changing now. One of the things that's changed is an end to the conservative political correctness that says that in the aftermath of a mass shooting, you can't talk about what it would have taken to prevent that mass shooting. You notice how that's changed? It used to be you had to wait. They would say, well, we got to wait until after. Unfortunately, there is no day that's not the immediate aftermath of a mass shooting in this country, which is why we've got to talk about it now. Another thing that's changing again is just the sheer presence of people. Remember, the NRA is where it is because they can mobilize a lot of single-issue voters who allow this issue to trump all the others. I think there's a lot of people out here who, just by your presence, make clear to candidates for office that this issue can't be ignored. Another thing that's happening that's incredibly powerful is the moral urgency of youth, wondering whether they are being counted in our political system. This is the extraordinary thing that came out of the March for Our Lives and is happening all around the country now. I was at an event a few days ago where there was a 13-year-old. He asked what we were going to do to keep schools safe, and then he started shaking, and then he started crying. And it turned out he was from near Newtown, Connecticut, and you do the math, the 13-year-old today was 6 or 7 then. And of course, I walked him through all the policy things that I believe in, that I think we all believe in, but the bigger thing going through my mind was, you shouldn't have to be worrying about this. Getting through middle school is hard enough without worrying about your physical safety. I was in high school when Columbine happened. I feel like I belong to the first generation where school shootings were routine. The second generation is now rising up to make sure there will not be a third. And unlike the spectacle of the 1960s when you saw young people marching into confrontations with their parents, what I see today is young people marching and their parents and their grandparents at their side cheering them on. It is the generational alliance that's going to change things in this country. It is beautiful. It is extraordinary. And I am convinced it will be the reason why things really are different this time. Because shame on us, God help us, if 20 years from now there's a candidate forum with presidential candidates in the aftermath of mass shootings and a day-to-day beat of daily shootings saying, okay, what are we going to do to make sure it's different this time? Let's not let that happen. Let's make sure that 20 years from now, we are proud of what we did in 2020, and we can tell our kids, you'll never believe this, but there used to be daily shootings in this country. There used to be mass shootings all the time, and 2020 was when we took the action. 2019 was when we took the action to make sure that it never happened.
We are ending this forum with the remarks of Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota.
DeAndre, do you have the first question for the senator?
What would you do if you were elected as president of the United States to enact gun safety in America?
I guess I'd answer that simply. I would get it done. And I would get it done because I have seen the journey that we are on. I started back as a prosecutor leading a major office in Minnesota and saw gun violence in a very visceral way with the cases in our office. And I came out early in a big hunting state, actually, in favor of the assault weapon ban. From there, I got elected to the U.S. Senate, and I thought, okay, this is the moment when we can get things done. And I was on this journey with you. And still marks the saddest day in my time in office when I had those moms and dads from Sandy Hook in my office. And late into the night, we had been working on the background check bill. Remember that in the Senate? Calling people, and I remember I talked to Senator Manchin, and he had me call people, and then they were in my office. I had to tell them that we didn't have the votes to get it passed. And I remember one of the moms saying to me, you know, my little boy was autistic. Every day before he went to school, he would point to the picture of the school aide that was with him every day. And as he left that last day, I loved him as much as I always did. And hours later, she was in that firehouse, and one by one, those kids would come in. And pretty soon the parents left, knew they would never see their babies again. And as she's sobbing, she said, she's thinking about her boy and everything about him, and a little image flashes of that school aide because she knew that she would never leave his side. And when they found them, that woman had her arm around that little boy and they were both shot dead. They had the courage to come to Washington to advocate for something that they knew in that case wouldn't have saved their kids, but would save so many other people, especially in domestic violence and in suicide cases. But Congress didn't have the courage to pass it. Well, let me tell you what has happened and why I know I can get this done as president. What has happened because of all of you is a change. And that change started, I think, after Parkland. You had built the groundwork for that change, and especially those of you who have had violence and lost loved ones in your own families. But after Parkland, when those kids stood up and talked, kids all over the country watched it. And they felt emboldened, and they started talking to their dads and to their grandpas and their moms and in hunting families and said, why can't we get this done? And the answer came in the 2018 election, when we elected a whole new group of candidates, right? Including right here in this state, Cindy and Abby, who were willing to vote for background checks and willing to do common sense things when it came to gun violence. That's what happened. And now we're at a different point. I started my 20-county Iowa tour in front of a barn with a flag. And as I stood there, I thought to myself, the same flag is flying over El Paso today and Dayton. And there is so much more, despite what this president tweets out every day and what he says, there is so much more that unites us than divides us in the United States of America. And when he says there are two sides after Charlottesville, no, there is only one side, and that is the American side. And that is the importance of this, is to get to rural areas and just talk to people. We've got a guy in the White House that's afraid. He's afraid of the NRA. How do I know that? I sat across from the president in the White House at that meeting after Parkland. All the leaders on these issues were there, and I sat directly across from him. And I wrote down on a piece of paper how many times he said he wanted to pass those bills. 9 times. And you know what happened the next day? He went and met with the NRA, and he folded. Well, as your president, I will never fold. All right? Let's get this done. So that is why I know what we can get done. I hope we can get those votes, and then we'll pass the background check bill, right? And then we will move forward on the waiting times and on the closing the boyfriend loophole, where if you're convicted of a serious crime, which is domestic abuse, then you can't go out and get a gun, because there's such a high correlation with those kinds of convictions and someone committing homicide. My hope is we get those things done now, but when I'm president in the first 100 days, if we haven't done that, I can literally close that boyfriend loophole myself, number one. You don't need Congress to get that done. And then number two, we will get the Center for Disease Control to start researching gun violence again. I can do that in 100 days. And then we will introduce sweeping legislation when it comes to everything from banning military-style assault weapons to magazine limitations. I would get it done.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to speakers at the Gun Sense Forum held in Des Moines, Iowa on August 10th, 2019. I've been your host, Susan Franzen, at KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa. The recording was made by Lily Balke of Pacifica Network and Public News Service. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Susan Franzen in Ames, Iowa. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Well, you needn't be lonely because the thrill is just beginning. At KBOO Portland, where it's 11:59 a.m., which means in now less than 60 seconds, you will be joined by the illustrious, the inimitable, and just what a guy, Don Jacobson, bringing you approximately 90 minutes of the very best in roots folk Americana that you will ever hear anywhere in this or any other universe. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Coming up first is a couple of announcements from around your community. So stay tuned for Moving On with your host, Don Jacobson.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I am Count Two-Up. And I host a podcast hosted on KBOO called Down the Road a Piece with Count Two Up. I'll play and talk about much of the fine music that was created from 1945 to 1965. This includes mainly two up or group harmony with some blues, jazz, pop, gospel sprinkled throughout. To listen to the show, go to kboo.fm/program/down